Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is music business writer Zach O'Malley Greenberg. But first of all, we almost had the first concert based on social distancing at Temple Live at Fort Smith, Arkansas, with Travis McCready. So this is a venue that's about 1,100 people, but they're going to pare it down to 229. And they were really taking a lot of precautions. One-way walkways, 10 per restroom, restricted fan pods of 12 that were 6 feet away from another fan pod. Everybody had to wear a mask, temperature checks before you enter the building, prepackaged beverages. They even went as far as disinfecting mist via fog sprayers. So this sounded like it was going to work, and certainly the venue jumped through hoops to make it happen. However, the governor shut it down, saying it was outside the state's pandemic directive, so they didn't give them a permit. Turns out that the venue was going to go ahead anyway, and that forced the governor to revoke their liquor license, which did shut it down. So we didn't see that first social distance concert yet. It looks like it might be coming, though. The Event Safety Alliance, which is pretty big, actually. It's been going on for a long time. They just released a 29-page reopening guide. And this document is for every venue that basically gives them guidance on how they should open their venues and what they should do in order to keep everything clean and disinfected. Now, at Temple Live, it looks like they actually went through most of that, but they probably jumped the gun on the time period of when everybody felt it was a good time to happen. Tickets were being sold by Ticketmaster. There were no reports on how many tickets were actually sold. That being said, there's a lot of pent-up demand to go out and see live music, and there's a lot of people that just want to get out of the house. So expect this to happen pretty soon, if not by the time you listen to this podcast. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. You can also sign up for my free vocal mixing techniques mini course at bobbyosinskicourses.com and download free ebooks and PDF downloads on mixing, production, mastering, and social media at bobbyosinski.com/free-resources. Now, I'm sure you've seen these really slick quarantine band performances. You've seen artists on Jimmy Fallon and The Late Late Show. You've seen Blue Oyster Cult and Joan Jett and Sting and Dua Lipa and all sorts of different artists that are out there doing these concerts with their band. And you probably scratched your head and thought, how are they doing that? And I did too. I started to look at the various apps that are available. Jamkazam and Acapella are a couple of them. But still, there's lots of latency and there's no way to really pull it off the way you're seeing it on television. And there's a good reason. That's because there's a lot of post-production involved. None of that is really live. You probably figured this out, but just in case you didn't, what everybody does is they're either playing to a click track or a guide track. And of course, they may be taking a phone video and crudely recording it live, but it's later being put together by a video editor. So it all comes out really slick looking and sounding. Obviously, the more people you have involved, the more difficult this is going to be and the more time it's going to take. But it is being done. It is kind of refreshing, the fact that so much is raw and live. And I think we all like that when it's all said and done. There comes a point in time where you go, oh, I think I'd like it to be slicker, but now is a good time for all this. So give it a try yourself. Just remember that it's going to take a little more work and a little more time than you might have expected. My guest today is Zach O'Malley Greenberg, who's a senior editor of media and entertainment at Forbes and author of 4 excellent music-oriented business books. His latest, A-List Angels, is how a band of actors, artists, and athletes cashed in on the latest tech boom and changed the face of Silicon Valley. His previous books include 3 Kings, about Diddy, Dr. Dre, and Jay-Z, and hip-hop's multi-million-dollar rise, Michael Jackson Incorporated, and the Jay-Z biography, Empire State of Mind. Zach's work has also appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Vanity Fair, Vibe, Billboard, Sports Illustrated, McSweeney's, and the Library of Congress. He's been a source for BBC, NPR, MTV, and 60 Minutes, and a speaker at South by Southwest, CES, TEDx, Princeton, and Harvard. During the interview, we spoke about the similarities between media business moguls, how certain entertainment celebrities got involved with tech, Zach's approach to interviewing famous people, and much more. I spoke with Zach via Zoom from his home in New York City. You started writing really early, and I guess that's because your parents were writers, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a funny way, I actually tried to avoid writing because my parents were writers. As long as I could, I really wanted to try to do something completely different. And my initial dream was to be a Major League Baseball general manager. But I fell into writing pretty early. I was actually age 14 when I published my first story, which was a video game review for Boys Life magazine, which for a while I thought was the coolest job anybody could ever have. And, you know, was receiving the Sega Dreamcast many weeks ahead of its launch and getting to write about it and actually getting paid. So, you know, it was an exciting time, but that kind of started me on the path, the writing path. And I never really looked back.
I saw you were a baseball reporter at Yale. So that leads me to my next question. Obviously you're a baseball fan. Mets or Yankees?
Yankees all the way. But man, I've always been the kind of guy who would go to any baseball game, any team. I'd watch any MLB game that's on. And right about now, I would settle for a Little League game. I'm pretty baseball starved. So
yeah, I'm the same way. Now you're writing about a very interesting part of the music business. First of all, how did you get into writing about music and business? Because that seems to be off the path for you somehow.
Yeah, it, you know, it was until, you know, I'd say the music and business thing came together in pieces. And the first piece was when I was at school writing for the Yale Daily News about the baseball team and so forth. I saw a letter on the bulletin board and it said interns wanted Forbes magazine. And in fact, the editorial council had been an editor at my college paper in the past. And so, you know, a bunch of us applied. I ended up getting an internship summer 2005, really enjoyed it, went summer 2006. And I found that sort of the same mechanisms that interested me about baseball and baseball statistics, with, you know, I'd been playing fantasy baseball since I was 8 years old. A lot of them applied in the stock market. And, you know, the idea was to look for value, right? You could find by leafing through any number of, you know, books, you could figure out some indicators that would tell you that a baseball player would do better, you know, in the coming year than he did in the past. And similarly, back then, you know, I guess it was the newspaper mainly, you'd look through and you could look at the PE ratios of stocks and so forth. And although the categories were different and the metrics were different, it was sort of the same mechanism. So, you know, I kind of took to it and I started writing stock picks for Forbes as, I guess, a 19 or 20 year old, where I'd call up analysts on Wall Street and sort of pick their brains about a stock and develop a thesis and get it published in the magazine. And those started doing pretty well. And one thing led to another, and Forbes brought me on full time when I graduated. So the second piece of the music and business thing came again, sort of by chance. I was sitting in a cubicle shortly after I'd started and an editor walked in and she said, "Hey, would you like to help me put together the first ever list of the top earning rappers in the world?" And I said, "Of course." I'd always loved hip hop, grew up on it in New York, and one thing led to another. And pretty soon I had written the story about how Tupac was making more money dead than all but five living rappers. And then we put out a story in the magazine to that effect. And there was a little sidebar that said Hip Hop Cash Kings. And it listed Jay-Z, Diddy, and Dr. Dre as 1, 2, and 3, I believe, in that order. I think they were making $20 million a year or something like that in those days. And this is 2007. And, you know, I thought it was a fun story and went off to write my next thing. It was a general assignment kind of gig in those days. And I found myself driving around the desert in New Mexico on a story about nanotechnology to meet with some professor at Sandia Labs. And on the radio comes Forbes, 1, 2, 3. I get money. And lo and behold, Jay-Z, Diddy, and 50 Cent had put out a song, the Billion Dollar Remix, about being included on this Forbes list. And I got back to New York and everybody was sort of like, oh man, business journalism has never been so cool. So around that time, the editor who I had been working with left and she said, you should really make this your thing. So I did, and I turned the hip hop list into an annual thing, and kind of expanded it into, you know, full-time serious coverage of the business, not only of hip hop, but of music. And, you know, and then went on to more broadly work on our media entertainment coverage, from there.
So you've written, well, 4 books now. I haven't read the first couple, but what I found in looking at them was that you take a different approach to how these media moguls, music media moguls, are actually expanding their business. You're looking at it from a different way, where most people will look at it mostly coming from the music side. You look at it coming from the business side.
For sure. You know, I think that there's a thing that a dear friend of mine said who runs a startup, and he said, you know, all musicians are startups in a way. He's also a musician. And I think that's really apt because, you know, if you look at whether you're a musician, whether you're an entrepreneur, you know, putting together a company, you have to make a lot of the same decisions. You have to figure out when to quit your day job. You have to figure out, you know, if you're not independently wealthy, how are you going to fund your project, right? Whether it's, you know, hiring more people to you know, to code your website or your app or whatever, or whether it's, you know, hiring a team to run your tour. You know, how are you going to scale your business? How are you going to reach your customers? And I think that that's been sort of one of my guiding principles in writing these books is, you know, how can the stories of people like Jay-Z, who I wrote my first book about, how can the stories of some of the entrepreneurs I chronicle in my latest book, A-List Angels, from Ashton Kutcher to Shaquille O'Neal, how can they kind of inform, you know, people who are doing business and people who are on the creative side, you know, in the same way. And you know, and also how can it be fun? How can it be a great story that'll be entertaining to read?
Have you noticed a common characteristic of all of the people that you wrote about?
There are a few, you know, I'd say that, you know, probably like a cluster, you know, less than everybody has all of these things, but a few of the things that pop up a lot are, one is the ability to ask questions. May seem really basic, but Ashton Kutcher, who was sort of the main character of this latest book, I interviewed him for a Forbes cover story several years ago, and he said, you know, when he's going to invest in startups, because that's his big thing now, he's got stakes in everything from Uber and Airbnb, like Uber's already public, but he was able to get into a lot of these great startups long before they went public. And what he would do is he would say, I don't mind sounding like the dumbest guy in the room. I just want to ask every question. You know, if I don't understand the jargon, I'm just going to ask, you know, if I don't get the acronym, I'm just going to ask. And I don't care if I sound stupid because I'm going to get the right answers. And I think that's a great lesson. You know, I think a lot of people in business and in music tend to gloss over stuff. You know, a lot of professionals tend to just breeze through and, you know, and maybe they know what they're talking about, or maybe they're just trying to, you know, sort of intimidate people with the language. But I think definitely, you know, not being afraid to ask those questions is super important.
How did A-List Angels come about?
Yeah, so it was that story really that got me thinking about it. And, you know, that was in 2016 that I wrote about Ashton. And I kind of realized that his journey and going from being an actor to being an investor in startups was something that was happening more and more throughout the entertainment business. And, you know, from actually 50 Cent really being, I think, one of the first to usher in the current era of stars investing in startups with his investment in Vitamin Water, you know, taking equity instead of endorsement when he created his Formula 50, vitamin water brand. He was a great example. Ashton Kutcher, Justin Bieber, got a stake in Spotify very early in his career in 2016. He's another person I covered at Forbes. So I started to see this new way of leveraging fame and really kind of the process of this class of laborers finding a way to grab a hold of the means of production, to put it in sort of like Marxist terms, you know, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, movie stars and musicians and athletes were all just paid a salary, you know, increasingly high salaries, but, you know, not something where they really got a chunk of the things that they created. And as time went on, really, it wasn't until the past decade or two that you started to see masses of these creators, you know, really kind of wake up to that notion and find a way to get stakes, not only, you know, ownership, not only in the things that they created, but, you know, other companies as well, and to sort of leverage that fame to get stakes in the hottest startups in this new tech economy.
It's not only about Ashton Kutcher, it's about lots of other music celebrities. How many did you cover in the book?
Yeah, I focused on a handful of folks. So Ashton Kutcher, Nas, Shaquille O'Neal, Sophia Bush, were some of the names up top. And then behind the scenes characters like Guy Osiri and Troy Carter were a couple who I talked to pretty extensively. And, you know, by talking to them, you really kind of get to understand, being at that perch of a manager, there's over the past 10 years or so really been this incredible opportunity of deal flow, and people will, you know, come to you and say, hey, you know, I've got this new startup, would your client like to invest? And in many cases, the client invests, and in many cases, the manager invests too. And in fact, Guy Osiri now has a couple of venture funds with Ashton Kutcher. So, you know, I think seeing not only the big names of, you know, the sort of like marquee names up top, but also the behind the scenes players kind of get in on this bonanza has been pretty fascinating too.
Was there a favorite strategy or a favorite story?
Yeah, you know, I'd say for sure there was no, one typical route, right? They ranged from Shaq telling me he invested in Google before it went public because he met some kid in a restaurant who recognized him and he was playing with this kid. And the kid's dad came up and said, hey, I'm an early investor in Google. Would you like to get into to something a little more carefully considered where Nas, who, you know, who's never really like the business guy, especially in the context of hip hop, where you have Jay-Z and Dre and Diddy, these all three near billionaires. Jay-Z's already a billionaire. Nas was sort of the one who hung back and focused on the music most of all. And, he teamed up with a bright young manager by the name of Anthony Sala, who I talked to as well, who kind of said, look, you know, you have a unique opportunity to get in on some of these companies. So they really kind of went about it very assiduously, you know, putting together a fund, investing in, you know, well over 100 different companies, figuring out, you know, places where Nas was uniquely suited to provide value. And then in other cases, just, finding ways to get in on companies that were objectively good where he didn't need to do anything. So, you know, I think one example where Nas brought a ton of value was with Rap Genius, now Genius, the lyrics site. It was, you know, fledgling company run by a bunch of, by three Ivy League kids in a Brooklyn apartment, and in comes Nas. He becomes their first verified artist, brings certain credibility to the platform, helps them, you know, deal with some of the publishing issues that come up when you're printing. They're excited. Not like Nas was necessarily going in and applying copyright law, but, you know, certainly he's one who can put you in touch with the people who can help with that kind of thing. Right. In general, really help build up a company like that. And in another case, if you look at Ring, the doorbell, virtual doorbell company, Nas was a really early investor in that. There's another one that his manager found and invested at a time when the company really needed money. He, you know, the founder happened to be a big Nas fan growing up, but he told me when Nas came in, he could have been, you know, pick any wealthy, influential person name out of a hat, and he didn't really care. He just needed the money to keep the business going, and he did, and he did really well with it, and ended up selling to Amazon for over $1 billion. Nas didn't really have to do anything. I mean, it wasn't like he was, you know, appearing in commercials for Ring, but he, you know, provided some capital and was able to do really well on that investment. So, you know, Nas ended up having the best earnings year of his career. In, I think it was 2018 or 2019, he made 40 some odd million dollars, you know, in his early 40s, you know, kind of like a late bloomer from a financial perspective, at least compared to some of his peers like Jay-Z. So, you know, there's no one way of doing it, right? There are a lot of different paths to success for some of these characters.
I haven't read the book yet, but I've read the teaser that you have on your website. And one thing jumped out at me. What's the Lady Gaga, Steve Jobs story?
Yeah. So, the phenomenon of entertainers investing in startups, I think is, you know, part of this broader convergence between technology and entertainment that's happened over the past couple of decades. And there's a great moment where Troy Carter, who was managing Lady Gaga at the time, brings her in to see Steve Jobs. And, she goes in and to Apple headquarters and he points to a table, and on the table are, it's like a half dozen things. There's an iPad, an iPod, an iPhone, an iMac, and an i something else. And, but that was it. And he turns to Gaga and he says, "This is what we do. You know, these are our main products, and it's all about simplicity. You have to make a half a dozen perfect things, you know, or at least as close to perfect as you can. It's about getting those half dozen things right. It's not about, you know, saturation." And I think Gaga is an act who's really kind of taken that advice to heart ever since. If you look at the number of albums she's put out, I mean, I think it's about the same as the number of items that were on the table. You know, I think it's about 5 studio albums for her at this point. So, you know, but she'll work for years and years and years to make sure it's exactly what needs to be. And sort of the coda to that chapter is that Shora takes her to meet with one of the founders of Google and Marissa Mayer, who was working at Google at the time. And they're all kind of bragging about how they've got this new color scheme on some part of the site, and they've A/B tested it to find this perfect shade of blue or green or whatever it was. And Gaga kind of scoffs it. She says, "Did Picasso A/B test his paintings?" So there are a lot of moments like that in the book, because it starts at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, you know, in the first chapter anyway, it gets into some of those early days of entertainment and the business of it, and it kind of takes you all the way through. So. In the second or third chapter, there's a whole bit on this notion of convergence. And, you know, in the 90s, there are a lot of kind of hilarious anecdotes of Hollywood and Silicon Valley not really understanding each other, you know, even into the aughts, you know, moments where, let's say, you know, Funny or Die, for example, was founded by Will Ferrell and a couple other Hollywood folks, but funded by Koya and, you know, a lot of venture capital money. And, you know, there's this great scene where Will Ferrell is being told that, you know, he doesn't have any budget to film his next video. They're like, "No, take a handy cam, go out and film something." And, you know, Will Ferrell and his partners are like, "Well, what about us? So we'd like to get a Van Halen song. What's the licensing budget?" "There's no budget." "You know, what about like hair and makeup?" "No budget, none, zero," like zero as in zero. And, you know, I think part of the tension that people had to figure out in those early days of this convergence was in music and entertainment more broadly, you start out doing things on spec, and once you achieve success, you get to a place where you get nice advances and sort of a mark of having made it. But when you're, you know, in Silicon Valley, the whole thing works in the way of you take a, you know, you pay yourself very little as you start your company, you build up equity, and then you sell the thing and you make a huge amount of money. And so, you know, the incentives and sort of like the way of getting paid is totally reversed. You go a few hundred miles from Southern California to Northern California, and it's just a totally different way of, you know, not being offered anything up front, or by trying to be lured to do things on spec. But really, that's just the way that Silicon Valley has always done things. And, you know, it wasn't really until the past decade that Hollywood and sort of the entertainment industry more broadly started to come around to that.
What's your favorite part of the book?
You know, I think, you know, the Nas anecdote, the Shaq anecdote, you know, some of this stuff. But toward the end of it, we get to the why we care. And, you know, obviously for people sitting at home, you know, especially in times like these, it's like, well, why do I care if Ashton Kutcher got to invest early in Uber and got, you know, did 100x his initial investment, you know, when, I mean, I can't really get tapped on the shoulder, you know, to do this myself. So the book gets into some of the social entrepreneurship, you know, some of the stuff that Bono has been doing with entities like the Rise Fund, which invests around the world in sort of like micro, any kind of like small, very, very small companies that are doing anything to help around the world. And the idea is actually trying to measure impact, to quantify it, and not just, you know, have it be some ooey gooey, up in the air kind of number, to actually say, we're investing in companies who are on the ground doing things. And we have this tool that can quantify how much impact it's having. So, you know, I think there's that. And then, you know, especially given current conditions, I think it's valuable to think about how somebody like Ashton Kutcher got into investing in all these startups. And we think about it now, these high flying companies from Uber to Airbnb and Spotify and you name it. But these were not sexy names back in, you know, 2009, 2010, when he was starting to invest. We were just coming out of the last great recession, and people had been burned by tech, and, you know, they were still kind of smarting from the late 90s dot-com bust. And then, you know, the great recession came along, and, you know, there really wasn't anybody from Hollywood going up, or from the music industry going up and trying to invest in these companies. And, you know, Ashton Kutcher was in there at a time when it wasn't sexy. And I think that's what helped get him a lot of credibility with the, you know, startup set, and, you know, ended up paying tremendous dividends for him down the line. So, you know, it's kind of like a silver lining of, when you look back in history, at some of the darkest times, it's when, you know, the people who are going to be doing well in the next decade are going around and they're most active, you know, trying to find the diamonds in the rough there.
You interview a lot of rather famous people. Do you have a different approach to doing that as compared to someone who isn't quite famous?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the main thing to remember, you know, with these interviews is that no matter how famous somebody is, they're just another human, and they are rarely treated as such. And so, you know, it's at some point you kind of become immune to it, but you can see it hitting other people. So, you know, if I'm walking around interviewing somebody or having dinner or getting out of a car with somebody, you know, you see the reactions on people's faces, and it's like, I mean, it's like they've seen a space alien. And, you know, I mean, the way they interact, they you know, there's a lot of, it can be kind of claustrophobia inducing. It's like very, sometimes can be very grabby. It can be like very in your face. Get me, get a picture. Let me sign this. Let me touch you, all this stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of these characters just, you know, it's exhausting for them. And, it's not often that people kind of talk to them as though they're people. So I think to whatever extent, you know, it's possible to do that, it's refreshing. And I think, you know, I think whoever you're interviewing, the more you make it seem like just a regular conversation between two human beings, the more relaxed everybody is, and the more honest the conversation is, and the more enlightening it is.
Given the situation that we're in now, if you were to look in your crystal ball, what do you see changing going forward? I'm talking mostly in the music business now.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, right now we've hit pause on all live events, and clearly that's a huge problem, because for most acts, big and small, that's, you know, huge center of income. And the whole argument about streaming was, you know, you get your music out there through these services, and it's you know, you don't get paid a ton, but it serves as a sort of advertising and almost like radio that you can go out and play gigs. Well, now you can't. So, you know, one of the things that I've been looking at a lot that's starting to come back are, you know, live streaming concerts. I wrote a story about a company by the name of Stage It back in 2012, and it was supposed to be the next big thing. This guy, Evan Lowenstein from Evan and Jerome, they did the song Crazy for This Girl back in 2000. And, so, you know, he created this company, he raised $3.5 million from Jimmy Buffett and Sean Parker and all these folks. And, but then it never really took off. And, I think what happened was, you know, it just, if you're doing a concert, if you're live streaming a show, you're still spending the time, and maybe you're not traveling, but you're still spending the time, and you're playing, and you're, you know, you're putting yourself out there. So, you know, I think the most they ever grossed in a single show on Stage It was close to $100,000. But, you know, if you're an arena act, you're doing 10 times that easy. You know, it's hard to have the same sort of scale, especially for bigger artists. And it's, you know, it's not like where when you tour and you're going to different cities and people are coming because they didn't get to see you in the last place. It's like, if you're streaming, the show, you know, well, maybe you missed it last night, but it's not like you can really do a streaming tour, in the same way. So there were a lot of one-off performers, and, you know, and the company didn't really go anywhere. And Evan told me he stopped funding it in 2015, just kind of scraping by. He said he pulled the oars in, and the company was just floating. And as recently as this past year, the end of last year, he said he thought that the only thing that could save his company was global warming, because acts like Coldplay would say, oh, I'm not going to tour anymore, I'm just going to do Stage It shows. And that didn't really happen. But really, you know, in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, I should say, you know, acts have suddenly been heading over to Stage It and of course to other live streaming outlets, you know, or even just going on YouTube Live or Facebook or Twitter or whatever. There are a million ways to do it. So, you know, I think companies like Stage It that have kind of like an integrated tip jar, stuff like that, are definitely, you know, certainly in the meantime, a place where you're going to see a lot of artists go. But, you know, I think now is a really great time to be kind of reflecting and creating, because we can't go on like forever. And I think that, at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, we'll start to get back to normal. And the artists that are really going to succeed are the ones who took the time to, you know, to just hole up and write a bunch and start, you know, creating great stuff. And, you know, the world will be ready to hear it when we all get back to normal. And, you know, or even the world will be ready to hear it when we're all hunkered down and, you know, hanging out inside. So I think that, you know, in a strange way, it's maybe flipping the paradigm back toward recorded music again, you know, as sort of an engine for the music industry.
Yeah, the only problem is, I don't know if you saw, but Amazon has suspended the online sales of CDs and vinyl as well, which that might put the nail in the coffin on both of those at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It's tricky for sure. And I guess with streaming, of course, you got to have a pretty big stream for it to really start to impact you. But, you know, some of the artists I've been talking to over this period of time really emphasize the importance of the super fans. And, you know, I think especially for, you know, what I like to call the vast middle class of musicians, super fans have been really at the core of, you know, how they make a living. And, you know, what can you do to entertain those super fans? You know, I think with things like live streaming, it's not so much about how many people can you get to pay to show up and tip you. It's not about quantity, it's about quality. Like, you might do better. You know, you might find 100 people willing to give you, you know, I don't know, I mean, $20 each if you're having a really intimate live stream where you can answer individual questions and play requests and stuff like that. You know, versus if you have 1,000 people, you know, paying you a couple of bucks to just kind of tune in and watch something. Because, you know, if you're just tuning into something that's not really personalized, well, then you might as well just go on YouTube and watch some, you know, archival footage of a concert. So I think it's when you can personalize to your core fans, your super fans, you know, that should be a great area of focus. And, you know, like, those are going to be the ones who sustain you through the tough times.
Last question, Zach. You have a different perspective, I think, given the environment that you swim in. Because most of the time I ask this question of musicians and people in the music business, and they have a different perspective than I think what you'll have. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe someone imparted to you, or maybe you learned along the way?
I would take it back to Jay-Z. Although he didn't tell me this, the only thing he really told me was that book was horrible. That was his review of my book. But he says it, you know, he's said this before and, in interviews and on, you know, in lyrics, but he says a loss ain't a loss. It's a lesson. Whatever you're going through, in your life, in your business, the odds are that there's something that you can get out of it that you can learn. And, you know, it seems to me that we're in a period where there's a lot to be learned and a lot of time to learn it. So, you know, that, I think that to me is the thing that has stuck with me. And, you know, it's kind of a comforting thing to lean back on when you're sitting there wondering how the hell everything is going to turn out. And, you know, gives a little bit of hope for the future.
You can find out more about Zach and his great books at zogreenberg.com. That's zogreenberg, GREENBURG, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com, select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.